all, on today's podcast episode, we are launching into a series from John Stone Street, president of the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview. So welcome to the Pathway to Purpose podcast. It is brought to you by FCCI. You know, and our goal with this podcast is to encourage and inspire Christian business entrepreneurs, owners, you know, leaders just like yourself as we spin up content from the FCCI Resource Library and engage in some conversation around compelling topics with Christian business leaders. And my guests today, Katie Lantuck and Colby Gilmore, thanks for being a part of our podcast and being with us today.
Hey, well, it's great to be here, Ken. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
So we'll hear from John Stone Street in just a few minutes, but wanted to start by having our audience get to know you both a little bit. And Katie, coming from Atlanta into our podcast today, I know you've got a couple of preteen kids and enjoy being a part of the faith-driven community there in the Atlanta area. And you're the founder and CEO of Murphy Marketing, but tell us more about you and what you do.
Yes, so actually my kids are a little younger. They're only 7 and 3, so we're not quite to the preteen stage thing. We have more time. But yeah, I love working with people who just kind of have a little bit of a complicated message. Either their industry is complex or hard to explain. A lot of times they're industry experts who really know what they're talking about, but it's hard to communicate to like kind of us normal people. So we help them simplify what they're saying and make it really easily understandable to their audience, and then easy for the audience to engage with and hopefully buy from them if it's a good fit. So we do a lot of question asking and a lot of listening, and then putting all that together into websites and email campaigns and lots of online marketing.
Well, I know that's not always an easy process. To make things easy is not always easy. And Colby, you work in an industry where things are not always easy to understand. As a private wealth advisor with Ron Blue Trust, appreciate the fact that you've been a part of an FCCI group in the Nashville area. Had a lot of fun over the past year getting to know you. You just had a baby boy, Kyrian. I'm so excited about you guys. You're changing family, but tell us more about you.
I've really enjoyed being a part of FCCI. Obviously, it's been years and years of collaboration between Ron Blue Trust, Ron Blue Company, and FCCI. So match made in heaven. Been just such a great group of mentors. The people you get to meet in these groups, it's fun for us that are a part of it, but it also, there's points where it's sad for me of family members and grandparents I've had that were business owners and believers that never had that collaborative, right? Of a place where they get to share and encourage and learn. And, so anyways, blessed by it, wish more people knew about it. My passion and what I do at Ron Blue is just helping Christians understand a biblically centered approach to handling what God's entrusted to us. Obviously money can get really complicated. The more we have of it, the more complicated it gets. But the more responsibility. So my joy is being able to open those doors, because there's a lot of freedom in the good book on just how to handle that money and steward it well, and to hopefully live more generously and with a better legacy. So you don't really work a day in your life when you get to connect your purpose, passion, and profession. So,
And I love the fact that, you know, when it comes to living out your passion, this, I think last year was maybe the first of the marriage conferences.
That was our first. It was years in the making. I'd always wanted to host Chris and Elisa Grace to host a marriage conference somewhere near us. We've been on their board at the Center for Marriage and Relationships at Biola, and they've been our personal marriage mentor. So it's personal. Everyone else needs to learn from them because they've helped us.
And so that's coming up. We're recording here in late July, 2023, and that is coming up August 26th at First Baptist Church in Nashville. And we'll put a link for that in our podcast show notes so people can find that. But you can go to cmr.biola.edu for more information about that. And so that would be something that you might want to take a look at. Great stuff there if you're local to the Nashville area, especially. So.
I mean, you can commute from wherever, you know, Chattanooga, Knoxville, Memphis, New York City, wherever. I'm just kidding.
The help is there. Come take advantage of it. It's good stuff. Well, we're going to take a listen to John Stone Street now, speaking to us from the 2021 FCCI International Conference in Bachelor Gulch, Colorado. this first segment of four that we'll be going through over the next few podcast episodes, the message around how do we really live within our cultural context. So let's hear from John as he greets the conference audience and starts with some kind words for Richard Blackaby and the Blackaby family, who had also just delivered a message earlier that same day.
I'm the president of an organization called the Colson Center. The Colson Center is one of two legacy organizations, one of two legacy organizations that were founded by the late Chuck Colson. Does that name ring a bell, Chuck Colson? So Chuck, of course, and let me just say too, Richard, it's so good to meet you officially in the back, and as somebody who looked up to your father a lot, I actually have to say that going through experiencing God when I was a college student was a pivotal thing. So I stand among those whose lives were deeply impacted because of the leadership of Henry Blackaby. I also stand as someone who was deeply impacted by Chuck Colson. If you don't know that name, I know most of you do. I speak to students. Fewer and fewer students know who Chuck Colson was, which is a real shame because he really was one of the great leaders of the church in the last generation, wasn't he? Chuck was known for his three lives. His first life was as Nixon's hatchet man, as special counsel to President Nixon. This was before he came to Christ. And, of course, he was smart. He was good. He was talented. You don't get to be special counsel, have your office next to the most powerful man in the world in your 30s if you're not really good. And Chuck was really, really good. In fact, he helped engineer Nixon's reelection campaign, won by one of the greatest landslides in American history. Stepped out of the White House, even as Watergate was starting to heat up, and he was lost. He was where maybe some of you have at some point found yourself, which is, what do you do when you're not only really good in your 30, but you've just, you know, you're in your mid-30s, and you've kind of hit the pinnacle of everything you wanted to do? What happens when you have everything you hoped you would ever have, and then what do you do next? Chuck went on a journey. Chuck went on a journey, and praise God, his life intersected with a man who had just come to Christ, a former business partner of his, a guy who had just come to Christ at a Billy Graham crusade. He went in to get his client back, and as he walked in the room, some of the other coworkers told Chuck, he said, well, Tom doesn't want to talk about business. He just wants to talk about Jesus. And that's what Tom did. And God used Tom Phillips in his life to bring Chuck Colson to Christ. The second part of Chuck's life, or the second life that Chuck had, of course, was going to prison for a Watergate-related charge. He didn't expect to kind of start his faith journey in prison, but that's exactly what happened. And as he got out, he actually committed his life to go back into the prison, to take Christ back into the prison, to share Christ with those who were incarcerated and their families. He worked for justice reform and all kinds of things. But that led him to that third part of his life. And really kind of why I'm here is the third part of Chuck's life is at this time that Chuck was building what became the largest prison ministry in the world. And you know it as prison fellowship ministries. Maybe some of you have been a part of something called Angel Tree. Does that ring a bell? Yeah. But something was happening in American culture. The prison population was exploding. It was exploding. In fact, I remember hearing Chuck complain about this on more than one occasion. He said, how is it that California can build and fill a prison faster than I can start a Bible study in one? And here are the numbers he used to give. This would have been 2010. He would say, you know, when I was in prison, there were 200,000 incarcerated Americans, and today, 2.2 million. And what happened? And here's what Chuck realized. Chuck realized two things. Number one is the brokenness that he was seeing in the prisons was not the cause, it was the effect of something that was broken upstream. So something was going wrong in culture that was leading to a brokenness downstream. And the second thing he wanted to know was this: where's the church? See, Chuck studied history, church history, and he realized that the church is always at its best, not when it's running away from the challenges of the cultural moment, but when it's running into the challenges of the cultural moment. And that brings us to where we're at tonight, talking about culture at a conference about purpose. Let me make that connection. We're going to talk about culture at a conference about purpose. Why? Well, the first reason we're going to talk about culture at a conference about purpose is, like it or not, even if we have a very clear sense of our purpose and what God wants us to do, we don't do that thing in a vacuum. We do that in a cultural moment. And I don't know if you've noticed, but there's a lot going on in our cultural moment. Is anybody else here maybe just a little bit dizzy by how quickly things went from being unthinkable to unquestionable, like overnight? So here's the moment that we're in. Look, I'm a dad. My wife Sarah's here with me, and we have four kids. They're all here. You might have seen three girls and a little boy running around. That's ours. We have three daughters, Abigail, Anna, and Allie, 16, 14, and 12. And we thought we were done. But you know what those girls did? Those girls went behind our back for 6 years and prayed that God would give them a little brother. So now we have a four-year-old running around. His name's Hunter. So it's Abigail, Anna, Allie, and Hunter. You put all the first letters together, and what's it spell? Ah! Yeah, that's it. Wasn't intentional, but it's quite appropriate. Look, as a dad, I want my kids to love God. I want them to follow God. I want them to understand why God made them. I want them to know who they are, made in God's image, remade in God's image through Christ and the Holy Spirit. And that would be hard enough. That would be hard enough to see that accomplished if I had nothing else, if Sarah and I had nothing else to deal with than just kind of their own independent thinking and their own fallen sin nature. I guess I was a little naive as a dad. I remember early on, I'd think, I'm just going to tell my kids what to think about God and that'll be it. I found out that wasn't the case really early. In fact, when my oldest daughter, Abigail, was just 3 years old and I was traveling and my wife was putting her and her little sister, Anna, who's now 12, or now 14, she was one at the time, Abigail and Sarah were putting Anna to bed. And on the way out of the room, Abigail leans in and looks at her little sister and says, "God will be with you tonight, Anna. God will be with you." Which was sweet, but then she turned around to my wife and said, "Hey, Mommy, I told Anna that God would be with her, and the other God will be with me." And I thought, oh no, I work for Chuck Colson, and my daughter's a polytheist. Like, how did that happen? But see, as we all know, it's not just dealing with our own independent thinking. It's not just trying to figure out who God is and what our purpose is, just kind of in a vacuum. We do it within the pressure of a cultural moment. And there's a lot going on in that cultural moment. But the other reason we're going to talk about culture in a conference where the theme is about purpose is we need to understand something about God's calling on us. The time and place that we are in human history, is not an accident. Do you have any of those things as Christians that you believe, as a Christian that you believe but don't really like? Do you know what I mean? Something that you believe because you're a Christian, but you don't really like it. This is one of those things. If you go to Acts chapter 17, you'll find there a conversation that the Apostle Paul has with a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. It's in a town, it's in the city of Athens. And Luke describes this whole scene, and it's really interesting because, you know, here you have Paul talking about Jesus and the resurrection, and this is a really philosophically minded town. In fact, as Luke describes Athens, he says, "The men of Athens love to do nothing more than to sit around and talk about the latest ideas." Does that sound familiar? And so they asked Paul to come and speak on Mars Hill. And so Paul actually doesn't start with Jesus. He goes all the way back to the creation. He goes all the way back to God. And he says, this is who God is. Now, what's really interesting is that Luke's very careful to tell us that his audience includes Epicureans and Stoics. I don't know if you know about Epicureans and Stoics, but they each had different views about the relationship with the gods to time and place. So the Epicureans believed that the gods had created the world that we live in, but had lost interest, and they had turned their back and moved on to other things, so no one was supervising us. So the Epicurean philosophy very quickly turned into a hedonistic lifestyle. You might have heard that phrase, "Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we dies." When Solomon writes that, he's in an Epicurean phase. And then Dave Matthews sang about it later. But you know what I'm talking about. The Stoics, on the other hand, had a different view of the relationship with the gods in time and place. They believed that the gods controlled every single aspect of our lives. So free will itself was actually an illusion. We didn't actually have a choice. The gods were determining everything. So to this group of people, Paul steps up, and to a group of people, one side of them believed that gods had no interest in what was happening here. The other group had basically thought that the gods controlled everything. And Paul says an awful lot. It's a really interesting passage. But one of the things he says is this, that the God who made everything created the exact times that people live and the boundaries of their dwelling place. Did you catch that? The God who created everything determined the exact times in which we would live and the boundaries of our dwelling place. In other words, the cultural moment that we find ourselves in is not an accident of history. It's actually part of our calling. You have a purpose. Maybe to write a book. Maybe to build a company. Maybe to parent your kids and husband your wife, or, you know, wife your husband. That sounds really weird, but you know what I mean. You have a purpose, but do you realize that part of your purpose is not just the what, it's the when and the where. Now, I don't really like that. You say, John, why don't you like that? Well, because I have four kids. I don't like the fact that God determined that they would live in this cultural moment and not in the lover. I don't know about you, but I wish my kids lived in a different cultural moment. I wish they lived in the good old days. I don't know when they were, but I read about them and they sound great. But what Paul tells me is that God determined that Abigail, Anna, Allie, Hunter, Sarah, and I would live in this time and in this place. So the cultural moment is part of our calling. There's a story that brings that to light to me in an incredible way. If you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., that one, and you go through the main exhibit, as you come out of that main exhibit, you'll pass basically this wall that celebrates those heroic Gentiles that helped out the Jews. Have you ever seen that? Anybody know what I'm talking about there? And there's thousands and thousands of names. Some of the more famous ones like Schindler and, you know, others, Bonhoeffer. But there's also a group there, a group of students there that are listed. They were called the White Rose. They were led by a brother and sister named Hans and Sophie Scholl. If you want to watch a really powerful movie, there's a film made in Germany with English subtitles about their life. It's called Sophie Scholl, The Final Days. And Scholl is S-C-H-O-L-L, Sophie Scholl, The Final Days. These are two young students who grew up in a typical German home. And I say typical because how they went, the direction that they went, was so out of step with the rest of Germany. I mean, here you have a very cultured, kind of historically Christian country. They were raised in a very cultural home, kind of as independent thinkers and so on. But they went to college. When they went to college, they were influenced by a group of professors who had real authentic faith in Jesus Christ. And so it led them into a deeper faith with Jesus Christ. And as their faith in Jesus Christ grew in college, which is a little bit ironic today, right? I mean, because a lot of times when kids go to college, they lose their faith in our time and place. But back then, in this situation, their faith strengthened. And the more that they grew in the faith, the more they realized that their faith was contradicting or conflicting with something that was happening, what they saw around them with Hitler and the Third Reich and all of that sort of stuff. So they just felt like they had to do something. So under the leadership of Hans Scholl and the support of his sister and several other students and a faculty advisor, they started a publication. And in this publication, which they produced six different times, they would document everything from human rights abuses to bad military decisions of the Third Reich, everything that they could. And then they would distribute it around their university campus and mail it anonymously to nearby neighborhoods. They did this six different times. Of course, they had to do this anonymously because if they got caught, then they would be punished. And that's exactly what happened. They were on their final distribution, or what was to be their final distribution, a sixth one. the students at the University of Munich, where they attended, were all off in an assembly. And so while the students were in this assembly, they were running around campus trying to put the stacks of these newsletters everywhere that they could. The students were just about to be released from the assembly, so Sophie Scholl saw this one stack that hadn't been distributed, so she grabbed it, she ran it to the top of the university tower, she pushed it over, and the paper scattered across the ground, and a janitor spotted her, turned them in for littering. But within 4 days, her brother, and another one of the students that was part of the White Rose had been brought in for questioning. They had been accused of treason. They had been put on trial. They had been convicted of treason, and they were executed by guillotine. All of that happened in 4 days. If you go to the university now, there's a memorial to the courage of these students. It's bronzed papers scattered across the ground. I first learned of this story from my friend Steve Garber, who's a wonderful thinker on a theology of education, and he was talking about this experience they had in education, but he said something really interesting. He said, for Hans Scholl, his motto was, I am Christian and I am German, therefore I'm responsible for Germany. Let me say that again. I'm Christian and I'm German, therefore I'm responsible for Germany. What a powerful idea that the fact that you're a follower of Christ and the fact that you're in a particular time and place are not incidental details in your life, but somehow together give you an understanding of who you were called to be, how you were called to be in this particular cultural moment. What if we saw these details of our lives that we think are incidental? Our birth year, our geographic region, our family structure, but we saw them less as accidents of history and more as callings. I mean, how would you write that equation out if you were doing it? I'm Christian and I'm Pennsylvanian, therefore I'm responsible for, I'm Christian and I'm Coloradan, I'm Christian and I'm American, I'm Christian and I'm a male, I'm Christian and I'm a female. All these details of our lives, what if they actually have something to do with who God is calling us to be and what He's calling us to do?
So as John was just mentioning, as he started off, talking about Chuck Colson and the heritage of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, and talking about Chuck's work in the prison and the brokenness that he saw there, and really understanding that that's not the problem. The problem's further upstream. And he made the comment about the church, right? He said, you know, kind of church, where are you? You know, church, you really need to be at your best when you're running into the issues of the cultural moment and not away from the issues of the cultural moment, and how powerful that is. That's our calling. So I'd love to hear, Colby, maybe your thoughts around what that's all about when it comes to the church and really engaging in our culture today as the church.
Yeah, that one, it sparked a lot of thought for me. But one thing, it brought back a memory of, I want to say it was like 2018, 2019. I heard Alistair Begg speak at a Kingdom Advisors conference, and he was talking about our cultural moment, and specifically around Daniel, which Alistair's typical fashion, he just read scripture and didn't really have to add anything to it. But he told the story of Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and how their cultural moments shifted. They shifted where what they were doing, the God they believed in, was no longer allowed, maybe even popular. But what did they do? Did they just scream and yell and say, you know, it used to be better, you know, the good old days, or, oh, we gotta just abandon everything, go create our own things and go abandon it? No, they didn't. They showed up and they prayed in their same spots. They could have hid things, right? They could have kept their mouths shut. They could have yelled, but they didn't. And well, we know the stories. They get thrown into the fire. They get thrown into a lion's den, but God carries them through that. And Alistair ended it with, well, our culture's changed. What are you going to do? And I think it's a great example as culture has changed, right? We live in a post-Christian culture. That's no new news to us. It's been a while, right? In the making. But the thing that I'd say that, I mean, especially for me and my spouse, is like what we've wrestled with in the church is knowing how come we are running away from it. We always want to distance ourselves or yell at it, but we don't actually engage in it and just go, why do we get to this point, right? That maybe the reason it's gone off the rails where it has is because we were comfortable for too long and we sat back and didn't do anything, right? That I like a little bit of culture where it is now more than probably where it's been, because it goes, wow, maybe we've got to really believe what we believe And if we really believe what we believe is true, how are we going to engage in that and actually go and do something, not just talk about it? So anyway, those are a couple of thoughts that came to me on that. I'm curious, Katie or Ken, any thoughts you have?
That your comment about not just talking about it. And I feel like so many times I see, you know, believers want to craft the right, like, comeback or statement or whatever. They're so focused on, like, what do we think about this? But I think when the church really acts the way that God intends is when we can come into that culture and serve and minister and take care of the people that we're, that are in our neighborhoods and our communities. And so I think instead of just formulating the best, like, it's funny I say that as a marketer, but instead of really formulating your talking points, to really care for people is the most important.
Yeah. I think of, you know, I spent about a dozen years in full-time church ministry, and I have to admit, I was guilty of being that church leader who really wanted to guard and protect the church, right? Like, keep everyone outside the church who might make it messy. You know, let's not let them come through the door almost. It was the sense, I mean, you would never say that. And yet that was kind of the aura, the culture that was often there in many church contexts. And I think it's so critical that we find ways to, as you just said, to engage in those conversations and to break down those barriers and not have those pre-made, pre-planned, pre-formulated responses because, mm-hmm. this is what we believe and we've got to make sure you hear us, hear what we believe, as opposed to, I want to listen, I want to receive, and how important that is. As I was taking a look at some of this content from John, I've been reading a book recently from E. Stanley Jones. It was recommended to me by one of my mentors. It's a book written in 1972, so I was 2 years old. But this guy writing a book called The Unshakable Kingdom and the Unchanging Person. And the power of the message of what is the kingdom, who is the kingdom for, and how does that kingdom apply today? Just an incredible resource that I would highly recommend. But just as he talked about, how do we break down all of the barriers in our society? And even referencing Matthew 13, you know, the seed parables and how the seed is meant to grow up together. And in the one parable that Jesus taught of, you know, the farmer sowing the seed and all the workers are saying, wait a minute, all these weeds are growing up. And he says, let them grow. Let them grow together. And God's going to work it out basically in the end. But let them grow, and that we are in a world where, yeah, we're together and we're side by side, and how critical it is that we just be what God's called us to be and allow God to work out the results. I thought that some of what he said around, you know, culture shifted from the unthinkable to the unquestionable in a moment, as he kind of shifted, as John was shifting in his talk into, you know, kind of how do we define or understand our purpose within this cultural moment. I wonder how that resonated with you guys, just that whole process of understanding what is this moment? And it's not just the what of the moment, but the when of the moment and the where of the moment.
Well, I remember I had a tennis coach at Biola that he was very good at giving speeches. And he would always say every day before practice, God gave you so much energy today, don't waste it. What are you going to do with it? And it's always kind of stuck with me that, right, your cultural moment is every single day. What is God's purpose for you to do today? And don't waste it. I know going through Bible school and stuff, there's always that like terror of like, I have to go to the missions field, but we forget that the missions field is exactly where your vocation is. It's right in your business, or in your community, in your neighborhood. The purpose is just figuring out what do you do? Like, it's not too complicated. What are you doing already? And just start living that out, going, well, all right, God owns this time. He owns this position. He's given me the skills. How do I just engage easy, little by little, right? And that concept of, I think you were mentioning a second ago, just of kind of in ushering in the kingdom is just like just being present and knowing God, right? It doesn't have to be, I believe, you go believe. It's just going, I know him. So it's a relation that I can go engage because that's my purpose. I had this time with my father early on our farm where I hated working. I was getting sick of his first job, and he came out and helped me on the wheel line. And for those, you know, that worked on a farm, that's irrigation. And he told me, he goes, you know, we work heartily for the Lord and not for men. In Colossians, it talks about that. So you're never going to always enjoy your spot in life, But that's a position on purpose that you can go and remember, it's not for man, it's for God. So how are you going to use it?
I've thought about that a good amount lately, and especially as you're raising young kids, you think, oh my goodness, there's stuff that we're kind of navigating that I don't feel like I navigated as a kid. And I'm sure my parents are like, what? But I think that with every generation, there's new stuff, and it's always been that way. And I think that if we, I don't know, instead of taking the position of being fearful and anxious and just worried about everything and chicken littling all day long, instead just saying, like, I don't know what to do about this, and asking the Lord for his help. And I think I've also seen the other side of that, that this time is actually really cool. There's a lot of really neat stuff happening. There's a lot of really great technology that can be good or evil. And I think that with the right, you know, people who love the Lord in place and working as unto him, we can leverage, you know, good over evil.
Yeah. Well, I had noted today, I was looking on Breakpoint with us listening to John Stone Street today. I was on the Breakpoint website, and their post today, the podcast, the article that they had posted, he said this: the only way forward for the Christ follower is to commit again to knowing what is true, to commit again to saying and living what is true, even if there is a cost, and to say and to live what is true in a way that is pleasing to Christ. In other words, faithfulness will involve both what we believe and how we'll live it out. And I think that's such a great statement. And yet, even as he said, it's really complex. You know, with shifting cultures, mm-hmm. he talked about that undercurrent that carries you down the shore. And boy, if you're not really rock solid in your truth. And yet within our culture, communicating that truth, I think, is probably one of the hardest things that we deal with. How do we really get people to understand the truth when truth is all, of course, relevant? And you mentioned, Katie, you know, raising kids in this cultural context within this environment. And I have a son who's a police officer now. And so that being in a culture and in an environment where things have really changed, the truth has shifted, and the identity and the respect for certain identities has shifted so dramatically. And how do we really navigate that? So, curious, Colby, I know with having a new little one, just as you're processing that and thinking through, you know, cultural context and raising kids as well.
Yeah. I guess all of us have had kids. It's funny how when you're, you know, well, my wife's pregnant or you have a baby, how everyone has a comment to share, and how probably 99% of the time it's negative. So I remember hearing this of like, why would you bring a kid into this world? And I've heard that from two sides, believers and non-believers, which is funny to me that both probably believe in completely different aspects of culture are saying the same thing. But we never had that worry. We're actually excited to go, you know what? We did grow up in the church, and that we were very blessed to be in that position. But there's things also we learned along the way that we had to kind of reevaluate and question. And that helped us make us stronger, right? That ability to be allowed to question, that we go, how exciting for Kieran and our future kids to go, let's let them wrestle. Not that it was this kind of this, not that it's wrong, but sometimes our upbringing was like, it's this way, you know, and don't ever question it. And it makes me think when I hear, like he mentioned, John did, hey, when kids go to college, they lose their faith. And when I often look at that, I go and see my peers that lost faith or gained faith. It goes, it's not, the institutions didn't screw them up. They didn't get brainwashed. It was, maybe they never really believed what they believed, right? They didn't know it was real, or they never were allowed to know the other sides and question it. So all of a sudden you get another opinion that's kind of persuasive. You go, well, that shatters everything. Yeah. So it makes me go, hey, well, we're in this unique culture, and I'm excited to have a kid and maybe multiple kids or whatever it may bring, to go, what can you do and how can we do this differently? And we're going to for sure screw it up. But I'm excited to go, well, maybe we can do a little bit better this generation, and or at least allowing him. And to a couple of the points we've said, the whole New Testament, when I read it, and I'm not great at reading it, it's hopeful. It's never fearful. It's not this gospel message of fear, but hope. But yet we can so easily in our church body go, we got to be afraid of everything. And it's like, that's not true. We should be very hopeful. God's got it figured out. What do we do? We don't really believe it.
And I'm so curious as far as for both of you, as you look back on, you know, John had mentioned the idea of the details of our lives are not incidental, that they're part of our calling. And I know, Colby, you've shifted from California now in Tennessee. Katie, at one point, I think you said you grew up in Knoxville, right? Mm-hmm. Now in Atlanta. Yeah. And just even the where has God planted us at a particular time? And how does that influence this calling that he's placed on our lives? And just how you've seen that shape and form you through the years.
That's been huge for me. I went through once I graduated from college until today, I've lived in a bunch of different places. I've worked a ton of different jobs in different industries. And I felt like for the longest time, I was honestly ashamed of my resume. I felt like the typical millennial that couldn't stay anywhere. And I had a very negative view of my like work history. But I can look back and see now that each of those steps was a stepping stone into what I'm able to do now. It gave me a huge generalist background. I understand how a bunch of different types of businesses worked because I worked in a lot of them. And I used to be extremely shy and hated to talk to strangers. But by moving around and living in like LA, Florence, Italy, Atlanta, back to Knoxville, I like had to learn through experience that, you know, you have to talk to strangers sometimes, and being like a functioning introvert in the world is important. And I look back on all the little stepping stones that brought me to where I am today with such gratitude. And I see the hand that God was, you know, guiding me throughout all of that. So I think place is really cool and very important.
Yeah. Colby, how about your journey to where you are today?
Yeah, I always like the quote from Soren Kierkegaard that life's lived forward, but it's understood backwards, yeah. Right? That obviously in planning, financial planning, it's a lot of looking to the forward, but behavior is all about the past of just going, hey, what do we do along the way? And then it's kind of like the Ebenezer Stone, right? That like when we go, God doesn't answer our prayers, do thing. It's often like, well, did we look in the rearview mirror? Because he's carried us this far, right? So I kind of have three stages of life so far. Is one, I grew up in a small little town in Oregon, Sisters, Oregon, on a farm, surrounded by family. So it was very much, you're surrounded by the family farm, and that's a belief. Then I moved to LA, did college, got my first jobs, got married, and have, you know, that's a whole nother shift there. Oregon's still, you know, kind of weird, but LA is a lot bigger and weird. And being able to go, okay, wrestling with your faith, even though, you know, I've been a Christian for a long time, but a faith on your own in a city and at Laguna Beach is where we're at, of people that really aren't believers, that like you're kind of the minority, that someone's like, well, you're a Christian? Like, tell me about that. And it was really interesting to go like, oh, I have all the recorded, I have all the apologetics for this, but to be like, how do you engage someone in the specifics where they're like, they look at it maybe negatively or weirdly. And then coming here to Nashville where it's like, well, we're all Christians. We can speak Jesus. We don't know him, but we can speak it. So it's been really unique, but it's been cool to go and progress and go like, okay, God, you've given us positions to know, like, you know, evangelism isn't just this weird, like just show up and you got to just start like, you know, bashing them with the Bible and they're going to come to Christ. It's like getting to know someone that's completely different than you, that opened up my worldview greater than ever, because small town didn't have any of that. You go to a big town, you start going, oh wow, people are different. That's a good thing. And then you come back to a place where now you're all Christians, but you're different. I think really eye-opening to go, hey, there's all this church and there's all these people, but you have communicating honestly sometimes is a lot easier to a non-believer than to the believer, right? Just some of those things. So I've loved it. It's opened up doors that I think that I'm sure Katie's had, that's going to other countries too. That's kind of like the end of the earth. This is, it's not bad to get out of your box and see other things and learn the culture. Cause that's, I mean, otherwise we're hiding in our box. But it is cool to just know, even though I'm only 30, all the little things along the way that you go back and go, wow, God, okay, you did that. Cause that helps here. Like I grew up in a family business cause now I can help family businesses through the good and the bad dynamics, right? Or just knowing, hey, I have a couple friends that are non-believers. Well, I remember those conversations and some of the bad ones I had and the good ones and going, okay, maybe we are able to better listen to them and love on them and be friends with them. And it's not this transaction. It's a journey, right?
Yeah. I loved what, as John was talking about, you know, the Apostle Paul and his Mars Hill conversation in Athens and just how God worked in such a way to get him to Athens. You know, I mean, this journey that he was on, you know, escaping persecution here, there, and everywhere, and his friends and cohorts, you know, helping him move. And he finally gets to Athens and he's looking around and he's like, why in the world am I here? And he's seeing all this stuff, like, what is all of this? And then, you know, John talks about the Mars Hill speech and what he had to say to the Epicureans and the Stoics, and that's all great. But one of the things that I love in that passage, as I was rereading that this past week, is a little bit later, when the statement is made of God, his purpose was for the nations to seek after God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. And that's the New Living Translation. But I just loved how it said that, that the nations were perhaps to feel their way toward God and find him. That this process of, well, what is it that's going on and how does God expect? It's not necessarily just us standing up and beating the pulpit as much as being a part of a process and walking with people as they feel their way toward God and find him. And I just love that statement. And it, one of those passages that jumped out at me that I just never noticed before in the book of Acts, but just love how that just frames it up so beautifully that within our cultural moment that, yeah, let's just be on that journey together and walk that path together.
Well, Ken, that makes me think of, I know John referenced Dave Matthews in his thing. There's a kind of folky country artist called Tyler Childers that released a whole gospel album recently. And it's funny because he's got a song very much of like all the interesting people you're going to see in heaven that you never really thought about, right? That like, he's like, we might have baptisms of all kinds. And who knows, maybe some Mormons or Muslims, but it may be a little bit more universalist than we might believe. But it is funny that you kind of think about it. You're like, oh, those people are never going to get there. But we're all feeling our way in different aspects, right? And that I even had kind of a breakdown moment where I'm in an apologetics group with Search Ministries and got to have these intense conversations with a few friends that were like, they really wanted to believe, they just couldn't. And I laid out the logic and they just didn't want to believe. And I remember coming back going like, why doesn't it work? But not realizing they go, they might be right on the way. They're just a couple steps over. There might be a couple more boulders for them to crawl over. And it really opened me up going like, you're right. This isn't my job. It's God's. And I don't know. They might be right there. They're going to be surprised I'm there, right?
I just love John Stone Street's statement that, yes, we have a purpose. But it's not just the what. It's also the when and the where in this cultural moment. So my thanks to Katie, Colby, for joining me for this podcast. We'll enjoy more conversations with Christian business leaders just like you on our next episode, so do be sure to let others know about the podcast. And if you would, check out fcci.org and all the ways that the Fellowship of Companies for Christ can serve you. Until next time, may God continue to encourage your journey as you lead a company for Christ.